This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Reg Haines grew up in Winston-Salem, steeped in North Carolina business, politics, and art. He was born into the family that created the Haines Clothing Company. His father and uncle served in the General Assembly, and they were four generations, they were supporters of projects like the North Carolina Symphony and the North Carolina Museum of Art. The Haines were an active political family with strong ties to the Democratic Party. That drove Reg to join a group that lobbied Congress on behalf of the arts community. And when a controversial photography exhibit made national headlines, Reg Haines met with Senator Jesse Helms to try to save public funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. He has written a novel that mirrors much of that lobbying experience. It's called Billy Bowater. We're going to talk about that book and the life and times of Reg Haines as he joins us today on The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here, Frank.
So tell us about growing up in Winston-Salem in that family. They were into politics, into art, and into business the minute you came into the world. That's the world you grew up in.
I did. You never know why, but it was from earliest time that I can remember. Sunday lunch after church at my grandfather's house. And as kids, we were always allowed to at least be with adults, and we listened to conversations. And if we came too eager in voicing in, we were told to just listen. But but it was always, it came back to politics or to the community, because it was a tradition.
Well, let's see how far back that tradition goes. We know the Haines Clothing Company, of course. But your family didn't start out in clothing, start out in tobacco, right?
Yeah. My great-grandfather, John Wesley Haines, and his brother, Pleasant Henderson Haines, started a tobacco company. Ples was in the Civil War, and the two of them lost three brothers during the war and as a result of the war. When Ples came home, he became a tobacco salesman and figured, well, I'm making this fellow a lot of money. I can do this myself. So he got his younger brother, John, and they started the P.A. Haines Tobacco Company in 1872 and then sold it to R.J. Reynolds when they broke up the trust busting, when they broke up American Tobacco. Reynolds started buying companies, and the first one he bought was P.A. Haines in 1900.
When did you get into the clothing business, or when did the family get into clothing?
Well, they didn't. John was offered the job as president of Reynolds and didn't think being in the tobacco business was going to be a good idea in the future. A bit prescient, apparently. But they got bored, and so John started Shamrock Hosiery Mills, which became Haines Hosiery Mills, with his son Jim, who was my grandfather. And Ples started the Haines Knitting Companies, making men's and boys' underwear, with his son, Huber. And so the two brothers started two separate companies in the same town after being in business together. And then in 1967, my father and Huber Jr. merged those two companies back into Haines Corporation.
That's one of the unique features, I guess, of North Carolina's economy that, and perhaps it's because of tobacco and the railroads and banking, all of those things that were in place in the 19th century, that it became one of the most, if not the most, industrialized state in the South. There were lots of industries, textiles being one of them, that you could make a living at.
Yeah, textiles and furniture was a big issue. And the reason originally was clearly because the labor was cheaper than in New England. So people like Millikan, Deering Millikan, which moved to South Carolina, a lot of companies did, and basically looking after a less expensive labor. But the difference was between that and a lot of other of the regions. We were talking about West Virginia, for example. The people who owned the resources, who owned the assets and the manufacturing, lived here, as opposed to absentee ownership, which happened frequently in other parts of the country. So they were vitally interested, as Mr. Duke was, in the quality of life in the community. That would be the state or the local community that they lived in. So they took a tremendous interest in the education and in the general welfare of the communities that they lived.
And that's, I guess, reflected in a lot of your father's career. In the North Carolina Senate, he was the one who introduced the bill that created the North Carolina School of the Arts. Am I right?
You're right. Exactly. He, at the urging of Governor Terry Sanford, my dad introduced the bill. It was proposed to Governor Sanford, who said to me before himself, I wasn't, you know, well-versed in the arts. It wasn't something that seemed important to me, but it was very important to people whose opinion I respected. So John Ely and Arturo Giannini, who had proposed a conservatory to train North Carolina citizens in all of the forms of performing arts, was important. And so he was had the foresight to say, if it's important to them, it's important to me, and asked my father if he would help him shepherd it through a very dubious at some times legislature.
Well, talk about that, because, you know, we there is this idea that North Carolina is more progressive, or at least have been, when it came to the arts and education. And it was a more industrialized state, so it had these kind of things going for it. But there was certainly resistance. And in fact, on the floor of the Senate, there was kind of one great moment when a senator rose to oppose your father's your father's bill. And tell us that story.
I think that you're referring to the infamous tippy-toe speech where I was in the gallery at the time. In fact, I was a student at Duke at the time. My father was proposing this school and describing it, and another senator from a county that I don't remember apparently stood up and he said, would the senator from Forsyth yield the floor? And Dad said, I will yield to the gentleman from wherever. He said, now I want to make sure I understand this correct, Senator Haynes. You are proposing, and the governor, to take the taxpayers' money in this state and spend it on a school for arts. He said, that's correct. So someday when my young son, whomever, Earl, says to me, Daddy, more than anything in the world, I want to learn to dance on my tippy toes. And I'm going to say, Earl, how lucky you are to be in North Carolina, because we have a school that'll teach you to learn to dance on your tippy toes. Well, the place went absolutely silent, as you can imagine. And those people who had possibly good arguments against it were certainly not going to stand up and side with the tippy-toe speech. So that plus a little nudging on other issues, as is always the case mm-hmm. with legislature, it passed and created what I think is one of the greatest conservatories in this country.
We are meeting E.C. Haynes, also known as Reg Haynes, today on The State of Things. He's written a book called Billy Bowater, and that is the novel under the name E.C. Haynes, and we'll talk more about that. But again, this tradition, your uncle was also in state politics, right?
Well, yes, a couple were. Robert Haynes, who was my grandfather's brother, was the president and CEO of Wachovia Bank and had been in the legislature a number of terms himself. It was I think sort of an obligation, or at least it was something that this group of brothers felt particularly strong about. He created with Luther Hodges the Research Triangle Park, and in fact the administrative building there bears his name. And he foresaw the need for a community that was no longer based just on hourly labor. And that's why they created Research Triangle, was to try to bring the state into an educational and a profile.
And that, again, like the School of the Arts, RTP back in the 1960s was seen as a bold vision where a lot of people just laughed it off the map, North Carolina and high tech and North Carolina and the arts. So as brilliant as it all seems now, they met with some resistance and had to kind of fight to see the vision through.
Well, I'm told, I'm not old enough to remember exactly those arguments, but I remember during the discussions that it was very tenuous for a long time because as is today. There was no manufacturing allowed. They were not seeking companies to build production facilities. They were seeking brain power and to utilize the formidable resources of the University of North Carolina and Chapel Hill and State and Duke, which are an extraordinary collection of intellectual resources for the world, much less. And I think, like all things, there's a resistance at first, but because people were more used to trying to get manufacturing in traditional businesses. And Uncle Rob said that this is not the future. And fortunately, with Governor Hodges, they were able to prevail.
On the State of Things today, we are talking with Reg Haines, former chair of the American Arts Alliance, a native of Winston-Salem, and we will continue our conversation on the State of Things after this. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm talking today with Reg Haines, former chair of the American Arts Alliance, North Carolina native and author of the novel Billy Bowater. We're talking about some of the more difficult issues that your family took on, and one of them was in Winston when your father sued to integrate a park. Tell us that story.
My dad was in the state senate, and Mr. Will Reynolds, RJ's brother, gave his estate, which is called Tanglewood, to the white citizens of Forsyth County. Now, in fairness to Mr. Reynolds, he also gave a piece of property to the Negro, I think is what his will said, citizens of Forsyth County, called Reynolds Park. But with time, clearly you could not run a public park that was segregated. And so my father filed suit in the 60s. To break the will. Now, basically, if the will was broken, supposedly it would go back to the Reynolds heirs. And this was not a real popular idea, considering how much money had been invested in it. But they couldn't run it any longer, so he filed suit. And very possibly he lost the following election. But I recall the discussions, and he was asked by a friend, that was a stupid move. Why would you file suit right before an election? And he said, well, do you think it was the right decision to make? And the man said, yeah. But he said, well, then why are you even asking me that? We can't live on that kind of a principle.
Was the suit successful?
Yes.
Yeah.
They broke the will.
And, you know, and again, apparently there were robust conversations about politics around the Haines household. You had an uncle who worked in Washington for a while for FDR, who is not always the most popular man in your household.
My Uncle John, another one of my grandfather's brothers. There were six brothers. And John was a financier, and he moved to New York and was with founding partner Barney and became involved in the politics of New York and the city and bailing them out, actually, one time. And he went to Washington as undersecretary of the Treasury in charge of world monetary policy. He used to brief Roosevelt every morning. He couldn't stand Roosevelt, he said, but he was the president and it was loyalty to him. But he grew to have great admiration for him, and he was subsequently appointed chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the conversations at Christmas when Johnny was back here got pretty heated. I remember one day at Sunday lunch, and I said that Mrs. Barber said Franklin Roosevelt was the greatest president in the history of America. My grandfather broke the leaf at the end of the dining room table, said she's a damn liar.
So in all of this ferment and, again, robust conversation around public policy and politics, where were you in all of this, and what was going through your mind as a young man? Did you decide early on that you wanted a public life?
No, I really didn't. I probably recognized that there was an obligation to do something, and, you know, one— in my situation, and any kid in that kind of situation is reminded constantly of the fact that they come from a successful family, and it can be in any number of fields, certainly, but you have a sense of an obligation. I had that sense that a lot was expected, and didn't necessarily know that it would be in public sector, but you didn't take that completely out of your mind, I guess.
You went to Duke and studied economics, right?
Right.
Now, what were you planning? Were you going to get into business then? What were you going to do with that?
Well, I majored in economics because I didn't want to take, I wanted to take a more diversified thing, and I liked economics. I didn't want to major in business. It was too specific, so I got to take a lot more diverse kind of a curriculum. And I planned on going into business, at least until I realized that the government had other plans for me for quite a while. So
and that was to send you to Vietnam?
Eventually, yes. Mm-hmm. I went to basic training in advanced infantry and then combat engineering, OCS, and was commissioned and spent 2 years active duty in the last 14 months in Vietnam.
After that, you came back and you did go into the family business, right?
I did. I went to work at Hanes Knitwear Division of Hanes Corporation for about 7 or 8 years.
And what were you doing there?
Well, I did a little of everything. I worked in manufacturing for probably a year to learn the business, which is an aberration among today's management. They sort of feel that once you get out and get an MBA that you can manage and run any business, which I think is a total falsehood, but nonetheless is what happens. But I was going to learn the business, and so my father made sure that I worked in every department, every shift. And so I did that and then eventually got into marketing. And then eventually discovered that if you're the son of the chairman, you had two alternatives, that half the people wouldn't tell you anything because they were afraid you were going to tell your father or suspected that. And the other half would tell you everything they thought you wanted to hear. So you got 100% of nonsense. And so I decided then that I would leave and see if I could start my own business with some associates. So I did that.
Tell us about that business.
Well, it started off, we were, I set up a company in Switzerland based on an invention, a printing technology that was primarily aimed at textiles, printing T-shirts and caps and sweatshirts and things. It was a patented technology produced by a French company and a Swiss company. And so we set up a business in Switzerland and licensed ourselves to the United States and then got into the business of coating ceramics and printing ceramics, and it eventually morphed into a general gift business, and we made plush animals. We had Christmas lines. We had sports licensing products, and we had probably 20,000 SKUs at one point.
Now, I understand that that technology was available, first made available to Hanes while you were there, and the board of directors turned it down.
Well, I doubt that it ever got to the board of directors. The president of the company at the time said this is really not something we want to pursue. We make those products. We don't really market technologies. And so they were not interested in it. It was brought to them. But I said, well, I think I am. So I left and I pursued that independently.
In the meantime, you got involved or somewhere along the way, the American Arts Alliance. Tell us about their organization and how you got involved.
Well, I was by a friend, was asked to be on the board of the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, Texas. And while on the board, I made the acquaintance of a great guy named Sherman Lee, who in fact moved to Chapel Hill eventually. He was the director of the Cleveland Museum, and he was the chairman of the Arts Alliance at the time. And so he asked me if I would join the board. The board did, so I was interested in it. I had been very involved. I was the chairman of the board of the North Carolina School of the Arts for a number of years. and had been involved in the Arts Council and lots of things as of great interest because of my mother and father, probably more than anything.
What did the Arts Alliance do? What does it do?
The American Arts Alliance was created by the professionals in the arts business, the executive directors, managers of the service organizations. So like all nonprofit theater has an umbrella organization called Theater Communications Group, which looks after and helps and counsels and so forth, all the nonprofit theater. But the American Symphony Orchestra League, the Dance USA, Opera America, the National Association of Museum Directors, they're all service organizations. And I think, truthfully, they felt a little left out of some of the other organizations, like the American Council for the Arts, which I also served on, was composed primarily of business leaders and arts advocates, but didn't have a lot of professionals who felt that, truthfully, they're the ones who really know what was going on. So they set up the American Arts Alliance in order to lobby the federal government, primarily for the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, as well as Institute of Museum Services and other similar groups. So that was their primary function, was to make sure that the federal government recognized the importance of cultural funding.
And sure enough, the federal government recognized the importance of funding the arts, perhaps in a way they hadn't anticipated when Robert Mapplethorpe got public funding for a controversial exhibit of his that exposed the male anatomy, and it was precisely about homoerotic art and not simply the male form, and this caused a stir.
Well, it was actually the Mapplethorpe was the second primary issue. The thing that set it off, fortunate for me, being from North Carolina, was a show called Awards in the Visual Arts, which was a national juried competition that the NEA and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Equitable Life Assurance Company funded. And it was a juried show nationally and regionally. And one of the recipients that was chosen had one of the photographs that received a tremendous amount of attention, was viewed as sacrilegious and demeaning and whatever bad adjective you can think of. And so that started a furor aimed at the Southeast Center for Contemporary Art, which happened to be located in my grandfather's house. And so being from North Carolina, I was on the executive committee, and I was vice chairman of the Arts Alliance. They said, well, you need to go and talk to Senator Helms, who was the primary mover in eliminating the government support of the endowment. And then the Mapplethorpe show was to open at the Cochrane Museum in Washington. So we added that little joyful event to it.
And the photo you're describing, of course, we have chosen not to use the name of the photo, but the title. But in fact, this was a crucifix that was in a beaker of urine, the artist's urine.
Right.
And it was a photograph of that particular thing, which was considered sacrilegious by some, a work of art, nonetheless by others. And then the Mapplethorpe exhibit at the Corcoran. So now that Jesse Helms sees this is his chance. Here's your chance to really make a kind of a public statement that would certainly appeal to his base. And it's your job then at that point to go talk to Jesse Helms, right?
So I testified before the House committee. It was under Interior, which I have yet to figure out. But Congressman Sid Yates, chaired this subcommittee on the NEA, and I was called to testify on a couple of occasions to him, and then go see Senator Helms to try to get him to, if you would, back off of this attack on the National Endowment. And in fact, Alphonse D'Amato, which I never could figure out, from New York, tore a copy of the catalog up on the floor of the Senate and further denounced it. But it's the kind of issue that can certainly inflame rather than enlighten. So I was selected to enlighten, which is not always easy. And so I had a lot of conversations.
Well, tell us about some of those conversations. I'm trying to imagine you and Jesse Helms, you trying to defend the Mapplethorpe paintings, the Mapplethorpe photos, and then this other one to Jesse Helms, who's making great political headway by creating this kind of stir. How'd that go? What was going on? What were you saying?
Well, the first time I met with him, I walked in his office and said, "Senator, it's great pleasure, and my name is Reg Haynes." He goes, "Are you Gordon's boy?" And I went, "Oh, ouch. Yes, sir, I am." Well, it was no secret that my father and Senator Helms differed on about every issue that you can differ on. So once we had established exactly who was in which sandbox, he was very polite. He certainly was not impolite or rude, but he took me to task on this kind of a lack of values and American tradition, and went through the whole thing. And
my guest today is Reg Haynes, who goes by the name E.C. Haynes when he's the author of Billy Bowater. We're talking about it today on The State of Things. Well, there's a fair case that he can make once he gets past sort of the politics of pandering to your base. There's the question of whether or not he's not censoring the art, right? He's not saying we should somehow censor this art. He's just saying, look, should the public pay for this art? And so tell us how that conversation went.
Well, he never said this art. I mean, the thing that was his mantra, if you would, was so-called art. And I said, "Senator, if you will allow me, let me differ with you on this. It's not so-called art. It is, in fact, art. Now, maybe it's not very good art. Maybe it's amateurish. Maybe it's infantile. You can decide that it's lots of things. But it is art. I mean, art is simply how we communicate as human beings. And we do it well sometimes, and we do it very badly sometimes. But the government, which pays for libraries, and there's very little, usually, controversy, though banning books is still something that amazingly takes place, the government pays for that. The government pays for research, some of which is a failure, some of which turns out some pretty awful things. But you can't know at the beginning, or you can't guarantee that everything is going to be great art, as you say.
That still raises a question. It seems like a double-edged sword. If the government is going to pay for it, then if you have government-sponsored art, somebody's the paymaster here. So there's two ways to ask the question. What responsibility does the government have in selecting where the money goes? And then whatever answer you give, should I be worried that the government is choosing my art?
Well, the answer to the first part is, the government does not select the art. The government, for example, in the case of Mapplethorpe, made a gift to the Cincinnati Museum to do a retrospective show. They did not choose Robert Mapplethorpe. The NEA gave a grant to the Awards in the Visual Arts, monitored, managed by the Southeast Center for Contemporary Art. So the government is not choosing the art. The government is choosing an institution with a proven track record. For that matter, you could say the North Carolina Museum, as a legislator did before, they should not use Rubens' nudes, which showed human anatomy. The case can be made always that somebody's going to find an objection to it.
The other argument that you will have that you hear often, and I'm sure you heard it often, is that this is money that's supporting a kind of an elite group of people, not the mass of American people. So why should all of our taxpayers go to this elite art form? And I know you have an answer for that, too.
I've been accused of having an answer for everything. Well, first off, the question of elitism is one that I was forced to address before congressional committees and all. And I think a friend of mine and a guy who was on a number of committees, Theodore Bakel, once addressed this issue, the very thing of elitism in the arts and only enjoyed by a few. And he said, that is what is elite. That's an arrogance to imagine that our citizens of the meanest background do not enjoy and participate in art, because everyone does. If they choose to define it only in terms of the Metropolitan Opera and the price of tickets, then they do a gross disservice to the real meaning of art.
And it is that conversation and those arguments that led to the novel Billy Bowater, and I will talk to the author, Reg Haynes, when our conversation on the state of things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Reg Haynes, who, when you go to the shelves of your local bookstore to buy his novel Billy Bowater, you will see he goes by the name of E.C. Haynes as the author of that novel. And we've been talking about your battle with the right, essentially, but mostly in the person of Jesse Helms, over the NEA and arts funding. And that led, in some ways, to this novel. Tell us about Billy Bowater.
Well, Billy Bowater is... after all of my classes in what a novel is, basically follows the pattern of an individual's journey. It's the trek. You follow a person. In this case, William Walpole Bowater III, who comes from a very prosperous family on both sides, his mother's and father's, and has great expectations, was a Morehead scholar, and goes home after law school and goes somewhat awry. His marriage falls apart, and he is a bit of a lost soul. And so his father arranges for him to go to Washington as a legislative aide for the senior citizen from North Carolina, whose name is Wiley Grace Hoots.
I love that you just said senior citizen. I know you meant senior senator.
Senior
but
senator.
It kind of
yeah.
worked.
Well, he's both. Actually, he's both.
Yeah.
So Senator Hoots, who has been there for quite a while, is running for reelection. And the plot and the storyline takes place during an election, his fourth election to the United States Senate. And by this point, Billy... is the administrative assistant, the chief AA for Senator Hoots, and is involved in a campaign against a very popular and extremely well-funded ex-governor of North Carolina. And in the attempt to raise money and to be competitive and to stay in Washington, which is the ultimate goal of every election, then and now, they choose as an issue, based on the suggestion of his campaign advisors, of an art show at the Ackland Museum in Chapel Hill, which has particularly offensive works of art in it. And the show has been sponsored in part by the National Endowment and the state of North Carolina, since it's part of the state university system. So they choose this show as an issue.
And interestingly enough, you create a character in Billy Bowater who is both enthralled with the job and the power that goes with it and becomes increasingly connected to and attached to that job, and then begins to have problems with his own conscience as he sees the kind of pandering that's going on and the kind of abuse of power and even public trust, in the sense that distracting the public in a very important time over issues like this is something that troubles him.
Well, he likes on occasion to think that this is a great and noble calling, which it is, and that it is carried out by noble and altruistic men and women, which unfortunately sometimes it is not. And so he recognizes his almost addiction to this process. I thought it was interesting I watched the Roosevelt Ken Burns show, and interestingly enough, in I think the fifth edition, Roosevelt is reading a letter to his children after Christmas, and he said, "Children, I'm so sorry that we didn't get to spend as much time as I would like. It seems that life and yada yada so forth." But he said, "I needed to get back," and he said, "Sometimes I feel this is like a drug, totally addicted." And that's precisely the terminology that I used with Billy.
Can I get you to read for us?
Sure.
The book is Billy Bowater, the author E.C. Haines, my guest today on The State of Things.
Billy is describing, is talking about after a press conference, is talking about the man he works for, Wiley Hoots, who is the senior senator from North Carolina. And he's describing Wiley. "Wiley may be the shrewdest politician I've ever known, sophisticated enough to speak to the money, but plain enough to relate to the average voter. Yet behind his facade of humility is a pool of anger a mile deep. Even as a young man, Wiley had been someone who had to show 'em. He never could say exactly who 'em was, but he knew they were out there. He could see and hear 'em whispering, smirking, and laughing at him, some hick thinking he was good enough to come into their world. Getting even with 'em for their careless laughter was a lifelong mission for Wiley, and as he got older, 'em grew to include not just urban North Carolinians, but the whole damn country. Some folks accused him of being mean, but of course he didn't see himself that way. Quite the contrary, Wiley figured he was simply doing his Christian duty to lead the fallen back to the light. America to Wiley Hoots was fundamentally an extension of eastern North Carolina and the values that had nurtured and suckled its people for so long. For him, these core principles constituted a foundation for the resurrection of the American spirit. I'd always figured that Wiley's posturing was simply a ploy to stay in Washington, but the longer I worked for him, the more I came to understand that he really did believe he was on a restorative mission for God. Sometimes I hoped my initial instinct was right, because a true believer is far more dangerous than a glib phony, and a true believer, like Wiley, tired of being laughed at and carrying a bellyful of rage, is the most dangerous creature of all."
A passage from Billy Bowater. The author E.C. Haines is my guest today on The State of Things. Well, at least what you say about the true believer is that it is not cynical politics. At least this person is truly speaking their mind, and I know what they stand for. They're not shilling for some larger interest, and they're not being honest with me about why they're saying what they're saying.
And that's what Billy eventually does admire in Wiley, that he does believe it. The John Carter, who was the campaign manager, and Earl Anthony, who was the television evangelical preacher, he has no admiration for either one of them. But he has to have a certain admiration for Wiley, and yet, as he says, he is full of anger, that he has a bile in him that will erupt at any moment. And he finds that to be troubling, because what happens is that there is an arrogance with that, that you are wrong and I'm right. I remember seeing a documentary on Mr. Cheney, and he made the statement, which I was surprised at, that no man of principle compromises. And I thought, well, how the hell did you get through your marriage? I mean, I don't know of a human situation where people don't have to compromise in some way. It's the only sedative that will permit humankind to exist with each other, I imagine. But
there is that, and then there are other, I think, political creatures, perhaps, who make up the bulk of the political world these days, who are simply seduced by power, who are addicted to it. And so, in a way, the system prefers, right? I mean, the system screens for those who are addicted to power. And you actually came face to face with this. There's a passage in the book that comes directly from a conversation that you had with a lobbyist about the way, particularly the need to seek re-election plays into the hands of interest in Washington.
Well, there's a passage. There's a passage when Wiley and Billy are in New Orleans going to the Christian crusade that Earl Anthony is doing to prompt him.
I think we got a mark right there.
Huh?
That might be it. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got it. Yeah,
go ahead and read that for us, and we'll talk about it.
And Wiley has been interviewed, and he gets into a hotel, and there's all kind of throngs around it and everything, and he's waving and smiling, saying, "I'm not here for politics. I'm here to support Reverend Anthony," and so forth. And he goes to the elevator. Wiley smiled and headed toward the elevators, whispering out of the corner of his mouth, "They're all yours, Billy." "Hardly all mine, but still mine for a while." Standing there before the crowd of reporters and curious onlookers, bathed in the camera's lights, it wasn't hard to understand the addiction to all of this, to the throngs of obsequious hangers-on, moneyed lobbyists and clamoring media types. It's heroin without the needle, more expensive to sustain, but eventually is fatal. A good friend and mentor and an influential lobbyist once told me, "Billy, if I know you want another term in Congress, I own you." "John, that being the case, what's the answer?" I ask him. "Term limits. Otherwise, you're asking the junkies to stop on their own. They'll never do that. They cannot, Billy."
And that was a conversation you really had, or at least part of it, right?
Well, the whole thing. I was a great friend of mine, and still is, but not as active, a major K Street lobbyist. And we were talking about the Supreme Court decision. We're talking about money in politics. And he said, "My job was to win the point of view of my client. And you do that with money." And the fact of the matter is that the objective today in politics, I think, more than anything, is to stay in politics, just to stay in the light. And like Billy said, like Roosevelt said, it's a drug. It's an addiction, and until you do something, you can't shake that.
And Citizens United was the decision that allowed more and more money to flow to precisely feed that addiction and attract to public office precisely those people.
Politicians do not refuse phone calls from people that gave them $2 million. It doesn't happen.
You ran your own campaign. You ran unsuccessfully in 1996. Tell us about the campaign.
Well, I was running for the North Carolina Senate. I guess I finally came to a point where I said, "Well, you're really good at complaining, but in a republic, the only source of leadership is from the citizenry. So either do something or shut up." So I ran and was not successful in that campaign. But it was a great experience. It was probably the most revealing thing that I ever did as far as educating me to the public, to the average voters and to folks, because I shook hands with everybody at every location I could find.
My guest today is Reg Haines, talking to him on the state of things. He's written a novel called Billy Bowater. We're talking about his campaign for the Senate and the North Carolina Senate. And again, when we talk about money in politics, you had an experience with a trade organization. You were trying to solicit campaign funds, and you got what I guess at the time was a pretty surprising answer.
Yeah, I had I was serving on the State Film Commission with a gentleman who was the director of a trade organization. They represented all the companies within a certain industry, and I called him, you know, thinking, "Boy, we've been great friends, and you know, I'll get a contribution for my campaign." And I said, you know, "Whatever, Frank, I'd really love it. I'd like to send you a card and get a contribution from your group." He said, "Boy, I'd love to, Reg. I think you'd be a great candidate and a great senator for us, but I can't do it." And I said, "What do you mean, you can't or you won't?" And he said, "I can't." He said, "We have it as part of our bylaws that we can only give money to incumbents, that it's a proven fact that 80% of the incumbents are reelected, or whatever the figure was, yeah. I can't remember. And I said, well, don't you think that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy? You only give money to incumbents, yeah. Duh, we only elect incumbents. And he said, well, I agree with you, but
that's
simply the way the board has set the organization up.
So when you look today at the state of North Carolina, what education spending has meant, what spending on infrastructure, voting legislation, all of the things that have been happening recently, I wonder what your take on that is today.
Well, I have a very strong feeling that we're headed in just the wrong direction. I don't think that a great many of the legislators are insincere necessarily, but I think their view of the world is outdated. And just as my Uncle Rob said that he thought brain power and research and research triangle was the wave of the future, I think it still is. We're not going to get back the jobs that I used to work at Hanes Knitwear. We're not going to get back furniture jobs. So unless we've decided that we're going to compete against Bangladesh, simply continuing to lower wages and starve education is exactly, in my opinion, the wrong course. It doesn't make any sense to me. And the sort of delusion that we've given all of this money to education, it was never in the original budget this year, for example. And the money that they put back into it was money they took out of another pocket for pensions and for, money built up already in contracts with teachers. So it's kind of a joke.
On the state of things today, I'm talking with Reg Haines, former director of the American Arts Alliance, former candidate for state senate, part of a North Carolina family that founded the Haines Clothing Company. Reg Haines, thank you for talking with us today. What a
thank
pleasure.
You. Great pleasure.
You can find out more information about our show, past editions. The website is stateofthings.org. It's produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is the intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.